This is Kate Millard, March 18th, 1991. Introduction to Jung's Complex Theory.
Well, here we are again. Thank you all for coming. When I organized this talk, this series of talks together with the Jung Society last October, I did it rather quickly, and then I went off to Switzerland to present my thesis and graduate from the Jung Institute. When I again looked at the newsletter to see what it was I was speaking on, I decided that I had taken on quite a task in discussing Jung's life and work. I'm actually not going to talk about Jung's whole life and all of Jung's work tonight at all. But what I will do is two things. I'd like to give you some historical information about Carl Jung and the time in which he grew up, and in order to provide a kind of a foundation or a position out of which his kind of depth psychology arose in conjunction with the beginning of depth psychology altogether. We use the word depth psychology when we talk about a psychology which includes the unconscious in its work as well as the conscious. And then I'd like to talk specifically about the first theory, and more or less the underlying theory of Jungian work, which is the theory of complexes. And I had some sheets of paper out there for you. Did everybody find something there? The outline on this paper doesn't exactly follow this talk, but perhaps it will be helpful information, and you won't have to write so fast. So I'll start at the beginning with Carl Jung. He was born in 1875. He would be today 116 years old this year if he were alive. Freud was 19 years old when Jung was born. Adler was 5 years old, and Janet was 16 years old. Jung lived until 1961. He was 86 years old. So he was the youngest of those four great people who pioneered in the area of depth psychology. He also outlived all of them. He was a Swiss man. He lived in Switzerland his entire life. He was born in a small village called Kessville on the shores of the Bodensee, perhaps better known as Lake Constance. And he ended his life in Küsnacht, a somewhat larger village on the shores of the Lake of Zurich. When he was 6 months old, his family moved to another village called Laufen. Laufen is a small place on the Rhine River. As you might know, the Rhine River begins in Switzerland, kind of in the middle of Switzerland, and it flows slightly east and then a little bit north. And then it flows west and forms the border between Germany and Switzerland. And at some point along its route there, it falls quite some distance. And this is called the Rhinefall. And Laufen, this village, is at the Rhinefall. And the area, it's not anything like the Niagara Falls. I mean, although for the Swiss, it's their largest waterfall, and they think it's really quite special. And people urge you to go there. And, of course, I went there, and it's beautiful. The area is kind of rolling hills, but low in elevation, and the falls are wide, and there's lots of mist and foam and whatnot. And the whole area is kind of magical and dreamlike, and I like to think of that as being what this young child wandered through and wandered about, and also maybe even more significantly, what he listened to at night, but I'm sure that he could hear the sound of the falls when he was sleeping. So he lived there until he was 4. And then the family moved to a village outside of Basel. I guess you don't care what it's called, because I've missed the name of it. But anyway, this village now is actually a suburb of Basel. Basel is the capital of Switzerland, and He lived in this village in the Presbytery country home, his father being a rather nondescript Protestant chaplain. Jung was the namesake of his grandfather, Carl Gustav Jung, who was a very well-known and respected medical doctor. He was a rector at the university in Basel, and allegedly he was the illegitimate son of Goethe. This was never completely substantiated, but I think Jung liked to talk about this connection when he was growing up in Basel. His mother was Emily Preisberg. She was described by a family friend as being fat, ugly, authoritarian, and haughty. Some friend, I thought. Although Jung himself described her as being somewhat difficult and exhibiting parapsychological abilities. He had actually had an older brother, two years older, who lived only a few days. And he had a sister who was 9 years younger, who lived at home, never married, and I think mostly kind of lived in the shadow of her brother. This little bit of family information might possibly shed some light on, in a sociological way, on Jung's divergence from Freud. We talked about Freud last week quite a bit. Freud was the beloved firstborn son of a beautiful and doting mother. Whereas for Jung, he had always this image of a rather homely and ambivalent mother. And it seems to me that the very idea that a little boy would be jealous of his father and in love with his mother was something that would seem patently absurd to Jung. Jung identified as a child much more with his brilliant, romantic, and successful grandfather. He went to elementary school with the peasants in the village, and when he was 11, he entered the gymnasium in Basel. The gymnasium becomes a kind of equivalent to our high school, although the term is longer. The children are in gymnasium until the age of 20, and then they enter the university. After taking an examination there called the Matura. It's reported that as a child he daydreamed a lot, he read a lot, he studied little. He was ill once for 6 months and then miraculously overnight recovered. He barely passed mathematics in school, but did quite well in Latin. He chose to study medicine, probably on the footsteps of his grandfather, and he entered the University of Basel with a scholarship which was awarded to children who came from families of very modest means. Now, in 1900, in Switzerland, I made a slight error. You don't want to miss page two, do you? When Jung was in university, and this is a quite significant thing, happened to him, he became interested in the work of a young medium who was, in fact, a distant cousin of him, and her name was Helene Preisberg. And during the last year at the university, he attended sessions in which first she would move tables around, and then she began to personify a number of deceased relatives and acquaintances while she was in a trance state. And eventually, by the end of the year, she took on a total separate personality, and this personality traveled to Mars, and she traveled to the stars, and she also experienced past lives. And she spoke of long and complicated genealogies, and all of this became sort of more and more exaggerated until in these genealogies that she would relate when she was in this trance state, she would be able to include just about everybody. So Jung went to these sessions for at least a year, and in a discussion of this case, it was actually Carl Jung who classified and defined somnambulism, automatic writing, and hallucinations. There were two things about this experience with this Helene Price work that struck him. One was her ability, when in a trance state, to accomplish feats that she was completely unable to do in a normal state of awakening. For example, when she was in a trance, she could speak perfect High German. The woman in her normal state was speaking a dialect, a Swiss dialect of German that was common to the area around Basel, and she did not speak High German at all. And let me tell you, it's very difficult. That was one of the things that amazed him. And another thing that struck him was the distinct contrast in personality. The inner personality of this woman seemed to be quite serious, poised, and thoughtful, whereas her normal personality was very unbalanced and chaotic. Jung concluded from these observations that the inner personality was none other than a part of the medium's personality, only able to realize itself in the unconscious. In 1900, then, he was 25 years old, working on his dissertation using this case. And he decided at that time that he wanted to continue his studies in psychiatry. He had definite ideas at this early age of what psychology should be. And he had a working definition. His definition at that time of psychology was a scientific study of the human soul. He had learned by experience that split-off contents of the unconscious can take on the appearance of a human personality, whether they are projected outside in the form of a hallucination, or whether they take control of the conscious mind and form another personality, as had happened with this woman. He determined that these aspects or manifestations were, in fact, psychological realities. This dissertation led Jung at this early point in his career to touch upon the basic premise of his entire psychology, the one that I keep mentioning over and over again, perhaps because I think it's the most important notion of all, and that is that the unconscious psyche is a reality. At this time, I think that he came to this belief through observation. Later in his life, Jung was forced to confront the unconscious himself during a period of time which some people have called his creative illness. This confrontation with the unconscious provided, this later confrontation with the unconscious provided the experiential element which probably, at least I am supposing, could form the foundation of Jung's belief that the foremost requirement for training of anyone who is going to work with another person in psychology is to do one's own personal therapy or analysis. Jung believed that it was important to learn the theory. I said this last week too. It's important to learn the theory, but then just as important to forget the theory, and that it was in the experience that one would find the most worthwhile. Were you living in Switzerland at the turn of the century and you wanted to be a psychiatrist, what you would do would be to join the staff of a university mental hospital as a resident and then work your way up by degree into the medical, through the medical hierarchy. Jung was at that point, and he wished to leave Basel, I think because he was so closely identified with his family there. So he applied for a position at the famous Burgholzli Psychiatric Hospital in Zurich. It's quite a formidable place. I don't know if anyone's ever heard any stories about it, but you can't imagine it looks exactly today like it did in 1900, because everything that was built in 1900 looks exactly the same today in Switzerland. It's large and sits way up on the hill and looks out over the lake. And is still quite a famous hospital. At the time that Jung went to this hospital, the director was a man who was Switzerland's most prominent psychiatrist. His name was Eugen Bleuler, and he was soon to become universally known for his theory and description of schizophrenia, a term which he coined to replace the term dementia praecox. The word schizophrenia simply means splitting off of portions of the psyche. The term dementia praecox means profound and early deterioration of the brain. Not only did Bleuler abandon the term dementia praecox along with its assumption that dementia was the inevitable outcome of the disease, but he also differentiated four symptoms which he deemed specific to what he called schizophrenia. These are known classically and forevermore as the four A's. If you ever study psychology, you'll learn them. They are problems in association, affect, ambivalence, and autism. This man, Bleuler, was truly a devoted healer. He was an unmarried man. He lived at the hospital, which at that time was not so uncommon. Essentially, he lived with the patients. He participated in their eating, in their meals, in their work therapy, and he developed a very close emotional relationship with each one of them. It seems that he understood schizophrenic or psychotic patients better than anyone had before. He believed that schizophrenia could be stopped or regressed at any stage in its evolution. His efforts in this direction of therapeutic treatment were the most successful at that time in Europe. He pioneered a path in the United States that was followed by a man. He pioneered a path which was followed in the United States by a man named Adolf Meyer. Meyer wrote a paper in 1906 entitled The Fundamental Concepts of Dementia Praecox, which is today a milestone in the history of psychiatry. Jung likened entering the Bergholtzli as living in a kind of psychiatric monastery. He said that Bleuler was very exacting of his staff and of himself as well, that everybody worked very long hours. They did rounds 5 or 6 times a day. There was a continual interaction between the doctors and their patients. And by varying reports, everyone there seemed to be deeply absorbed in their work. As a resident at the Bergholtzli, Jung began to work with something called the Word Association Experiment. Now, this experiment was introduced by Bleuler at the hospital. Bleuler had the idea that the association experiment would show the difference, or be one way of helping to diagnose the difference between schizophrenia and hysteria. What they hoped to do was establish a correlation between the groups of associations to these words and psychopathological symptoms. Jung's question then was, do specific illnesses yield specific word associations? You understand what I mean? In other words, if people who could be diagnosed as schizophrenic would respond in a certain way to a stimulus word, and someone who might be hysteric would respond in a certain way, then you have a way of diagnosing that would have been a new way. As you probably know, of course, this is definitely not the case, so their idea was wrong. However, in the process of his exploration, Jung became more interested in the so-called faults of the experiment. And earlier, people had dismissed these faults merely as mistakes. But as we well know, in the history of humanity, it's always been rewarding to confront the mistakes. And often, it's through a mistake that a new key to a beginning has been found, and this was definitely the case with Jung. An understanding, basic understanding of the word association experiment is absolutely essential. in order to see exactly how Jung developed the theory of the complex, which led directly into his discovery of the collective unconscious in the world of the archetypes. This thing goes boom, 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 just like that. So I'm going to talk just very briefly about this experiment. It's pretty simple. You need to have three things. You need to have a setting, a protocol, and a subject. The protocol consists of a series of either 50 or 100 words. They're systematized using nouns, verbs, and adjectives, etc. The instructor then tells the subject then is instructed to respond as quickly as possible with the first single word that comes to his or her mind after they hear the stimulus word. For example, the first 5 words of the association experiment are play, mouth, free, car, make. Now, if I'm the test giver, what I do is I have a stopwatch. And so I start with the first word, and I say play, for example, and then the respondent says toys, and I click the stopwatch. So between the time that I say play and the respondent says toys, we have 4 seconds. So that's how it goes through all of the words. However, the other things that we learn to look for are certain faults. For example, the person may not have a response word, and there may be a time of, say, 20 seconds lapse in silence. Or the person might respond with a sentence, although he knows to respond with one word. Or he might respond in another language. Or there might be various hand movements or eye twitching. And the best way to do it is to decide 5 or 6 things that you're going to look for besides the word response, and then make abbreviations for those, and then you can begin to see them. If you don't do that, you get kind of lost because people react in a lot of different ways. Then this whole list is gone through like that with the time and the faults mentioned, and then you wait about an hour, and then you go through it again, the whole list, and you ask the person to respond with the same response word that they used the first time. That's the only thing you look for, and you don't time this. And surprisingly enough, people respond with almost all of the same words, but there are a few that they can't remember. And those are considered also to be faults or failures. These are called incorrect reproductions. And then one takes this gathered information, and you can see actually pretty clearly how these disturbed reactions are determined, and the contents of these can be grouped together, and they will form what Jung began to call complexes. If you ask somebody, after they've taken this association experiment, if there's anything that she has to report about it, she will probably say that some of the words were very difficult to respond to, and she will probably remember what those words were. And if you took those words and you put those words together, you would probably see that they're linked in some way. It's really quite something. If you take this experiment yourself, you will find that it's not just a rational thing. It sounds very simple. And has anyone ever taken a word association test? Well, many of you haven't. And if you have the opportunity to do so sometime, perhaps you might want to. But it's highly charged. There's usually either 50 or 100 on the ones that I'm familiar with. It's a very stressful situation, and it can really get to be an ordeal, although most people begin it thinking, oh, it's nothing to this. So these results started to make Jung suspect that the basis of the disturbed reactions are factors or entities in which a series of representations are held together by a common feeling tone. He therefore called them emotional complexes. It's possible to group the disturbed words and responses together and to fantasize a kind of story about them, and usually your story will come close to the disturbance. Jung became absolutely fascinated with this experiment. In fact, if you read through some of the old papers from the Berg-Holtzli, it seems that they were all possessed by this association experiment and were just running around and doing nothing but giving association experiments all the time over this period of a few years. There's a story here that it's rather brief that Jung apparently used to tell, that someone else told, that I have a copy of. And I thought I'd tell it to you. Jung once gave the experiment to a friend of his. This was a 70-year-old man. He was a lawyer. He did not believe in Jung's results, and he wanted to take the experiment in order to find fault with it. After the first 15 words, he became impatient, and he said, "You can't find anything anyhow," and he stopped the experiment. Jung saw that out of those 15 reactions, 5 of them were disturbed. I will read the 5 that were disturbed. I will read first the stimulus word and then the response. Money, little. Kiss, beautiful. Death, dying. Heart, prick or stick. Pay, paying. The last word he said in a different language, not German, but French. Jung was very angry at this man when he determined to stop this experiment after 15 words because he didn't believe him. And Jung said to him, "I can tell you exactly that you are impressed by this and that you are afraid because you feel a pricking in your heart very often and you also have financial problems. You connect all of these with an old French love story." The man said, "This is the work of the devil." And he ran off, but he went home and he said to his wife, "My God, this is just fantastic and you have to do it." Right. Yeah. At the Institute, as a student at the Institute, we had to do several of these experiments and attend the seminar and write a paper and interpret one of these, and it's pretty fascinating. Some people are really fascinated by it, and if you are, it can be a lot of fun. And some people find it boring. It's very time consuming, which is probably why people don't do it more. It takes a long time to calculate all of the times and things. And it's also important to be careful with the experiment and not use it lightly, because it does bring up always unconscious material, and sometimes that can be very upsetting to people. Jung and his buddy Ricklin, he was another psychiatrist that was working there at the time, published the first results of their association experiment in 1904, which, not surprisingly, as you might remember, is the same year that Freud published his book, The Psychopathology of Everyday Life. In this book, it's this book in which Freud discusses the all too human slips of the tongue and mispronouncing, forgetting errors, everyday occurrences, which people usually laugh off as meaningless. In fact, later in a later edition of Freud's book in 1907, he actually used Jung's word complex in referring to these disturbances of consciousness, which is how he called them when he was writing about them. The phenomena described in the psychopathology of everyday life, which Jung would later call complex indicators, were a source of both fascination and study for Freud and for Jung. And it was their independent study of these phenomena which actually brought them together. However, the implications which Freud drew from these phenomena differed greatly from the implications seen by Jung. Ultimately, as Freud points out in his book, The History of the Psychoanalytic Movement, one of the major factors which caused Jung's separation from the Freudian school was their differences regarding the meaning and the treatment of the psychological complex. Freud saw the complex as being negative, his method being to try and dissolve the complex and thereby free the person from the tyranny of it. He believed that the complex was only repressed ideas, and when they were again made conscious, that the problem would be resolved. Jung's view was to treat the complex as if it were neutral, noting that the complex may be seen as an obstacle to conscious functioning, as well as a stimulus to greater achievement. Jung believed that it was the complex, not the dream, as Freud had contended, that was the via regia, or the royal road to the unconscious and the archetype of dreams and symptoms. He said the complexes make up the structure of the unconscious. There is an image from mythology that might express well how Jung saw this complex. Perhaps you are familiar with the Janus head. It's a head that has two faces. One is smiling and one is frowning. Jungian analysis then would not attempt to dissolve this head, but rather to help the patient to learn that to be able to live with, to accept, and to make use of a head which has two faces. I'm going to tell another story now. It's a short one here. This is a story that Marie-Louise von Franz has written in a book called, the name of the book is The Puero Eternus. And it illustrates the difference in a Jungian and a Freudian approach to the complex. She's talking in here about the puer complex. The word puer is a Latin word. The puer complex alludes to this kind of eternal youth syndrome that may appear in some people that don't want to grow up. That's what her book's about. So from her book, she says, it seems that someone had come to work with Dr. von Franz from the United States and was suffering from the negative aspects of a puer complex. This young man had come over to Europe with a friend, and the friend decided that he would go into a Freudian analysis while Dr. von Franz's patient underwent a Jungian analysis. The two friends agreed to meet in a year and compare notes. When they met a year later, the friend who had undergone the Freudian analysis said that he was through with his particular problem, he was cured, and he was returning to the United States. He said that he had given up this nonsense about his mother complex and his other problems, which had all been a part of his infantile attitude towards life. Now his goals were to earn some money, even though he did not yet know how he was going to do this, and to find a wife. The friend who had been analyzed by Dr. von Franz said that he still wanted to be a writer, as he did before he went into therapy, and that now he was doing something about it. He said, however, that he was not cured at all, and that he still did not know where to go. Nothing was totally settled yet, but he knew definitely that he wanted to be a writer more than anything else. The friend who had had the Freudian analysis responded, "Well, it's strange. They have driven out my devils, but with them they have also driven out my angels." That's a favorite story around Jung Institutes.
Hey, I have a question.
Uh-huh. Yes. Yes. Absolutely. As conscious as possible. If bearing in mind this story, it seems that the attitude then that I'm trying to explain about the complexes towards these, the attitude towards these complexes within ourselves or our patients should be to observe their actions, to understand their meaning, and then to try to relate them to the total of all of our psychic processes. Now, what are they? These complexes that I'm talking about. I'll start to talk about them more specifically, first by giving you a definition from Jung. And then I will start to give some examples that perhaps will be helpful. In volume 8, Jung says, a feeling-toned complex is the image of a certain psychic situation which is strongly accentuated emotionally and is, moreover, incompatible with the habitual attitude of consciousness. This image has a powerful inner coherence. It has its own wholeness and a relatively high degree of autonomy. The complex can usually be suppressed by an effort of will, but not argued out of existence, and at the first suitable opportunity, it reappears with all its original strength. This I've just read comes from a lecture that Jung gave in 1934. And further on in the lecture, he said, everybody nowadays knows that people have complexes. What is not so well known, though far more important, is that the complexes have us. These complexes can be called the focal points in the life of the psyche. By this, we mean that the contents of the unconscious, connected by the same emotion around a nucleus of meaning. This nucleus is made up of an archetype being a universal pattern of behavior. For example, there is a person who has what we might call a primary positive mother complex, and this person will experience the world in a trusting way, basically. Whereas the negative mother complex will produce a distrust towards life. The archetype of the mother is neutral. The life experience creates the tone of the complex and the emotion around it. Now I give another example. This is an example of how the nuclear element, the archetype, and its secondary associations might be imaged. Now just imagine that here we have a young man sitting by the window, reading at his desk. The window is open. Suddenly he finds that he can no longer continue reading because he is unexplainably filled with feelings of depression and anxiety. As he closes his book, he realizes that strains of music are coming through the open window from a cafe downstairs. The song which is being played in the cafe is a song which his father used to sing often after coming home drunk and mistreating members of the family. The man is sad and depressed because the song has ushered in a highly emotional memory of those conflicts with which he was surrounded in his younger years. Now, the secondary association here is the song. And it has the same exact emotional value or charge that the nuclear element, which is the conflict with the father who was a drunkard, has. The student may be so overcome with depression or anxiety that he's not going to hear or pay any attention to the music coming in the window, but his negative father complex has been touched and he will feel it in all its consequences. One component of the nuclear element of this complex is the man's experience of having to live with a father who is a drunkard. The other component is the man's inborn image of what a father should be. Now, these two things are different. The archetype of the father, or the basic pattern, primordial image of what patterns of behavior a father should follow, is the second component in this nuclear element. This innate image or archetype of the father stands in basic conflict to this young man's actual personal experience of his particular father. This contrast is the source of conflict, and that is the complex, which spontaneously interrupts with a heavy emotional reaction both the intentions and the attention of the man as he sits by the window. Now, in theory, the complex is composed of a nuclear element which contains both innate and environmentally conditioned factors and a secondarily emotionally charged associations. In fact, all of these elements come together immediately and forcefully when a complex has been touched. In this example, the archetypal image, the personal experience, and the song come together in the time that it takes to blink an eye, and they produce very strong feelings of fear, anxiety, and depression, as well as having the power to interrupt this young man who's trying to read his book. These complexes are something we experience. This image of a certain psychic situation is the key to the beginning of an understanding of this whole thing. Can you imagine what that might mean? The image of a certain psychic situation. I tried to give a little example of that. Let's say there is a woman, and she, a young woman who's been recently married, and she receives a telephone call in the middle of the night informing her that her husband has been killed in a car accident. Now, even though this event happened 15 years ago, whenever her phone rings in the middle of the night, she is awakened, she's in great fear and trembling. Now, the phone call always brings up the image of the psychic situation, yeah? Even though that situation happened 15 years before. She's asleep, the phone rings, she emotionally experiences the same thing that happened 15 years ago, the abandonment that she felt at that time when suddenly her whole life changed, and all of the emotion that's connected with that time. That's what I mean by the image of the situation. She was in analysis with me, and in analysis she begins to discover that that she has this fear of abandonment. She becomes more conscious that she's pushed this fear away. And one of the ways that this has given shape in her life is that she's developed a pattern of getting involved in relationships where very little commitment is required. As long as she doesn't get committed to anyone in a relationship, then she doesn't suffer the possibility of being abandoned. So even though this is all unconscious for her, this event and the results of this event have formulated a pattern which has been going on for 15 years. She's protected herself from experiencing the intense emotion, the fear of loss, which is lodged in the repressed complex. However, as long as this complex lies in the unconscious, it's a double bind. Then she cannot enter into a meaningful relationship, which is what she seems to want and desires, and so that's the situation. Now, working with this person over a period of time, she becomes more and more aware that this complex exists, more conscious of when it might be activated. One way that might help to image this situation would be to describe the complex as a bruise. Now, we all know how we get a bruise. We had a lovely black eye here earlier tonight, but the child went home. But he got hit in the eye with a rock, he said, a small rock. Now, that hurt. If you have a bruise on your arm, it hurts when it gets there. But it also hurts if you push it. That's why we guard our arm and take care of it when we have a bruise on it. Jung used this term, a state of readiness, to describe the dynamics of the complex. He says that they sit there in the unconscious, ready to be pushed on. For example, now here's this client, the woman client again. Now she's now, later on in her work with me, she begins to enter into a relationship with a partner, and she's living with this partner, and they're getting along very well. One night, this partner doesn't follow his usual pattern of coming home after work. And she comes home, and she's not exactly waiting, but after a couple of hours, she realizes that he's not there, and time goes by, and it's in the winter, and it's slick outside, and it's dark, and as you can imagine, by 10 o'clock, she's decided that he's crashed his car and died. This is an absolute real situation for her. She's terrified. The old complex is then in what Jung calls this state of readiness. It's been sitting there for 15 years, and it's ready, and a certain amount of factors have come about, and they've pushed on it, and then it does what we say, it constellates the complex. The pain comes back to her in the same intensity as the original telephone call, and the person is absolutely panicked. She's constellated, that is, she's taken up a position from which she can be expected to react in a very definite way every time. You can absolutely see what's going to happen. As long as she remains unconscious of what's going on, she's going to have the same exact reactions. And that's exactly like a bruise. So this is why I'm using this bruise. When you hit it in just the same place, you cry out in pain every time. A psychic wound acts much the same way, but the whole process is usually largely unconscious. Now, with this particular client, she's aware. She's becoming aware that she has this complex, that she might experience these things. And so as this evening draws on, she realizes partially what's happening to her. This doesn't mean that she's able to stop it. One has no control over one's emotions. The fear is there. The awareness that she's experiencing a greater intensity of fear than need be for this particular situation is also there. And so she takes some measures. She calls a friend. She has her come over. They have a chat. And she waits until, in fact, the partner comes home. It took an enormous amount of effort for her to remain conscious and to remain in control of her emotions, but she did. She recovered more quickly, and when her partner came home, she was able to sit down and discuss this situation with her. What might have happened had she not been aware of what was going on, knowing this person as I do, I suspect that her waiting would have been accompanied by drinking, and by 10 o'clock she might have flown into a rage, or she might have waited until he got home and then flown into a rage and gone off, and she would have perhaps acted out in some way by going to a bar, maybe picking up somebody. It could have really been a disastrous end to an otherwise pretty good beginning of a relationship. As it was, it worked out well, and they made an agreement that if this needed to happen again, it wasn't that he had to come home, but if he could just phone. So that I think is a pretty good illustration of what happens when one starts to bring a complex into consciousness. The complex never goes away. But it, when it's conscious, it doesn't have you. You have some kind of relationship to it. So that was what we might say her bruise, or her, one of her bruises, or her sore spots. These sore spots or bruises manifest themselves in many different ways. Certain things that irritate us a lot more than they ought to. Hasn't there ever been a person that you met and hated? Or something like that. I know another example I wanted to tell you was one night someone came into my office, and they were a few minutes late. And he came in, and this man was in an absolute rage. I'm just furious. And I thought, you know, maybe he was furious because he was late, or I don't know, the traffic or something. And as we got to talking, what came about was that as he was driving in the traffic to my office, these two black young men jaywalked across the street slowly in front of his car. Now, he was maybe annoyed a little bit that there was some traffic, but the appearance of these two young black men who just blithely walked across the street pushed something in this man that he made him just fly into this rage. And the more that we talked about that, it appeared to me that this is really overly exaggerated, so there must be something else going on here. And some discussion of this, just very briefly, led to a very negative situation with his father when he was young. He always was taught what he could do or couldn't do, and in his household there were lots of rules, and things were very rigid, and he was never allowed to break any of those rules. And when he sat in the car and he saw these people take the liberty of walking in front of him, these elements in his psyche that had never been allowed to be free and spontaneous just caused this uproar, and probably happened on the way, maybe on the way to analysis also, so that many things happen like that. anyway, that was another thing that happened that I thought I would relate to you. When the complex is not acting like a bruise, it's usually acting like a magnet. That's the other way it works. The best example of the magnetic quality of the complex that there ever will be is falling in love. Jung wrote about falling in love, and it's so sweet the way he wrote about it that I decided that I would let him describe something that I'm sure and I hope at least that everybody's familiar with a little bit. He says, the lover is obsessed by his complex. His whole interest hangs solely on this complex. Every word, every object reminds him of his beloved. The most trivial objects are guarded like priceless jewels. Remember the notes in high school and the flowers and that are still in the box somewhere? Anything that does not suit the complex simply glances off. All other interests sink to nothing. There is a standstill, a temporary atrophy of the personality. I bet everybody in this room has lost at least one friend while they were in love. Usually happens when we're young. In attending to indifferent matters, the most extraordinary compromise formations are produced. Slips of the pen referring to the erotic complex creep into business letters. Suspicious slips of the tongue occur in speaking. The flow of objective thought is constantly interrupted by invasions from this complex. There are long gaps in one's thought which are filled out with erotic episodes. That's Jung at his best, I think. Truly, a person caught in the magnetic orbit of his own complex is like a person possessed. And as the primitives might say, possessed by a spirit. The complex is, in fact, the modern term for what was always called a demon. In order to understand how this possession can take place, we need to talk about another aspect of the complex, and an important one, and that is its autonomy. Jung himself said in the introduction to Yolanda Jacobi's book, he said, the thing that most impressed me was the peculiar autonomy of the complexes which they display as compared with other contents of the unconscious. I think that he was so impressed with the autonomy of the complexes because all of us are products of a culture where willpower is all important. We like to think that we are masters of our own fate. Do you remember the master of the universe in Bonfire of the Vanities? That's the term that really struck me in that book. The basis of the rational background of modern Western people does not easily allow for psychic realities which cannot be controlled. Jung used the term splinter psyches to describe the autonomous nature of the complex. He says the term autonomous is meant to indicate the capacity of the complexes to resist conscious attentions, to come and go as they please. Judging from all we know about them, they are psychic entities which are outside of the control of the conscious mind. They have been split off from consciousness and lead a separate existence in the dark realm of the unconscious, being at all times ready to hinder or to reinforce conscious functioning. The degree of autonomy of the complex depends upon how conscious the complex is. Essentially, we say that there are three kinds of complexes. One kind of complex are those that are conscious. Now, an example of a conscious complex would be the abandonment complex of the person that I mentioned who had the accidental husband's death in the telephone call. That complex now is a conscious complex. It's not altogether under control, but it's more or less, it's comparatively well integrated. At least sufficiently integrated that it doesn't take over. Then we have complexes which are not linked up with consciousness, which are emotional reactions that can't be accounted for. Occasionally we meet someone that we don't like, or we find someone absolutely unbearable, and we don't have any idea. Obviously these feelings don't have anything to do with the particular person, but they spark reactions in the unconscious. They spark an image of a psychic situation. The problem is that it's not so easy to bring up the image. Often that comes up in a dream, which is one of the reasons why we look at dreams so carefully. These complexes, the second kind of complexes, are connected to consciousness, but they've disappeared. And they've disappeared through this mechanism of repression, which we talked about when we talked about Freud. These are called unconscious complexes. Now, they are much more autonomous than the conscious complexes. And then there's a third kind of complex, which I haven't talked about yet and which I'm only going to touch on tonight. And this is a complex which has never before been conscious. This is a kind of complex which is experienced when something happens that is absolutely incompatible with conscious intentions and at the same time has a very high emotional charge. These two qualities, going against conscious intention and having an intense emotional charge, are exactly what was ascribed in the Middle Ages and in antiquity to demons. If you examine demonology of the times, you will quickly see how obsessions, possessions, and demons are described, and you will find absolutely no difference whatsoever between a demon and a complex. This phenomenon of something coming up and taking hold of us and making us do things that we never expected to do is frequently what happens when someone moves from one phase of life into another. We may find ourselves saying or doing things that we have never considered before. New material sometimes rather starts to spill out of the unconscious. And often this is very surprising. We'll talk about that perhaps in a little later. Maybe someone might have an example. I don't know. I want to say one more thing about the complex. Let me take a break. These complexes, they like to get together with other complexes. They like to join up with similar complexes in other people. They also like to connect up in large groups. It's not only with our viruses that we infect people, we also infect them with our complexes. The emotion when these complexes get together can be very strong. It can lead to increased creativity in a group situation where everybody is very much centered around something. And or it can also lead to increased destructivity. Or in a group situation, it can lead to seeing a problem very compulsively or unilaterally and forgetting to look at the other sides, and everybody supports everybody else. And pretty soon you have a consensus and you only really have looked at half of the material. In June, Carl Robinson is going to give a talk entitled When Psyches Do the Tango. And this is going to be a talk specifically about two people, I presume, in relationship and how their complexes interact and intermingle and what sorts of infections may arise from that. So that would be something to more or less follow up this sort of beginning discussion. I would like to stop now for about 10 minutes, and then I have 6 minutes more worth of material that I'd like to share with you. I'd like to talk a little bit about how I approach these complexes, and then we can discuss if you like. Okay, thanks. Factors. An element of mystery always remains. The presence of mystery, however, is not necessarily negative nor unscientific. And I believe that the ability to relate adequately to the presence of mystery may well be the genius of therapy. With this in mind, I want to say briefly about how, as a Jungian, I see an approach to the complex. For I think that this is the heart of the matter. And I'd like to give some credit to these following comments to a man named Tom Lavin, who was a student at the Institute in Zurich, and he wrote a diploma thesis there which I was able to read, and he wrote quite a lot about the complex, and I've using some of his material, not verbatim, but if you ever run into him. The question which remains is, what are we to do, and how are we to react towards these complexes once we become consciously aware of their presence? The best word that I can find to describe the basic attitude with which we can have towards the complex is the word religious. Bear with me. I know it doesn't have great positive feelings for everybody, but I'd like to define what I mean by the word religious. When Jung spoke, and he often spoke, of a religious attitude, he meant simply the careful observation and consideration of certain dynamic factors which are conceived of as powers. Finish. Want to hear it again? The careful observation and consideration of certain dynamic factors which are conceived of as powers. Without a religious attitude towards the contents of our unconscious, we might as well not even begin. For, as Jung has written, the unconscious will turn the same face towards us as we turn towards it. If we cannot overcome the all too natural feelings of fear and resistance towards the contents of our unconscious, the result will be a life which is lived with many neurotic symptoms as daily companions. These neurotic symptoms then represent the only avenue which is open to the psyche to make the contents of the unconscious known to and accepted by the conscious ego. The religious attitude means to deny the nothing but attitude which Jung so deplored. Reducing something to that which is known and devaluing that which is unknown. Oh, it's nothing but a case of nerves. Oh, it's nothing but a complex. I have heard people in the deepest throes of painful emotional suffering explain and devalue their suffering by saying that it's miserable weather that put them on edge. Relinquishing this nothing but attitude forces us to look at the unknown power as nothing other than an unknown power. The psychological complex must be met with an attitude of careful observation and consideration. It is much easier and much more comforting, and I must say much more popular, to use, for example, the term inner child when a complex is constellated, than to admit that we stand before an unknown power which possesses an autonomous character and which needs to be carefully observed and meditated upon. The religious attitude allows us to tolerate mystery, to tolerate not knowing. We can try to understand what's happening in the psyche without having to explain why something is happening, without constantly racing back to the childhood experience to try to explain the existence of a complex. And perhaps the most important aspect of a proper attitude towards the complex is that there is no attempt to cure or to dissolve our complexes or those who come to us for help. The religious attitude towards the complex has as its goal that we ourselves and our patients become and enter more deeply into the person we have the potentiality to be. Jung called this process individuation, which means we don't change ourselves or others. Rather, we cooperate with the dynamic factors which have come together without the aid and support of our egos in order that we might more fully approach the self in our own individual ways. In his autobiography, Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, I think Jung sums up exactly what I'm trying to say in this two sentences. He says, the images of the unconscious place a great responsibility upon a person. Failure to understand them, or a shirking of ethical responsibility, deprives him or her of her wholeness and imposes a painful fragmentariness upon her life. Thank you. The question that was brought up was the difference between, yeah? The beginning?
Yeah, right after the break.
Oh, after the break. Oh, well, did everybody hear it? Well, that's all right. We'll let that go. Or fix it later. Yeah. Well, if she cooperated, she did cooperate with the complex, I think, for the first 15 years, and I think that's why she was not able to become deeply emotionally involved with another person. Because in order to do that, she had to take a risk that she would perhaps be abandoned again. And so what she did in order to protect herself from the pain of that original experience was to not put herself into a position where that could happen again. She didn't do this consciously. She chose people who were unable to make commitment. Well, you don't want to cooperate with the complex when it's unconscious. I mean, when you become unconscious and you become involved with it and you don't know what's going on. Then she cooperated with it, if you will, in another way, in that she, let's say she could have sat there in her fear at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock and said, aha, there you are, fear. Now, a certain portion of you is justified. I mean, it's possible something happened. But the rest of you is really, you know, I really need to let you be there and realize that you're there and why you're there and not act out or overact. To that. Is that clear? Yeah. Joanne brought up a question just before I started talking about the difference between a complex which has never been conscious and an unconscious complex. Was that the question? Yeah. Well, as I was defining, the conscious complex is a complex that was once unconscious and has now been made conscious, like the woman we just talked about. Her abandonment complex. An unconscious complex is a complex which exists in the unconscious because it's been pushed there. The man who was in a rage over the two black people walking in front of his car, he was totally unaware and unconscious of the rage that he experienced as a child with his father. So that complex for him, when he walked into my office, was unconscious. But it had once been conscious. That's the second kind. The third kind that I mentioned briefly is a little bit harder to put your finger on. It's when something arises out of the level of the collective unconscious into consciousness that you didn't know was there. Would anybody have an example? I have one example, but it's quite personal, of course. Let's say that, the only example I could think of for the whole time I've been trying to think of one, which was before, well, maybe you can think of one. Absolutely, that could be a way in which something which had been, which had such amount of energy that it wanted to come to consciousness would break through. Carl? And just to keep it very general, that if we were to think about Circe, then, or if we were to have a dream that something like that appeared, then in the looking up and seeing what in the world is this about and what does this relate to, my guess is that always it would relate back to something in your personal life that was going to go somewhere. I don't know where you went with Circe, but, you know, something that would be both personal and archetypal and might make a big change. Well, it's different in the manner that it manifests. It's different in the sense that the unconscious complex was once conscious and got repressed and wanted to come. And the other complex there are all these possibilities lying down there in the unconscious, and some of them are gonna come up to some of us sometime, but that's part of the mystery. I mean, I don't know when or how. But they can be very, very striking occurrences when they happen. Yes. Oh my! Oh, lots of things. Lots of things came up in dreams around this issue. Yes, many things. Yeah. It. That's how it became more conscious, actually. Yeah. Well, one of the things I guess I didn't say, but I think it's on that. Like I said, that list I gave you is not exactly what I talked about, but reaching, gaining more information of what these complexes might be, is best done by gathering together all of the unconscious material one can. And in fact, I often say analysis is gathering all of the conscious and unconscious material that we can get together. And one of the most accessible ways to unconscious material is through dreams, because everybody dreams, and everybody might not remember their dreams. But given some consideration, I think most people do remember some dreams at least. And the dreams are often giving us information about complexes. In fact, probably all dreams are giving us information about complexes, since complexes are what make up the unconscious, different things around which there is emotion. And those are then exemplified in dreams through symbols. And a symbol is something which has an unlimited amount of meanings, but which holds emotion. And it's the connection to the emotion that we look for when we work with these dreams. The emotion around the symbol, so that emotion can be somehow released into consciousness. Larry? You know, I've seen people that go to work in their complexes. I mean, that pick a place of work that absolutely exactly mirrors their own personal complex. And to have somebody realize that one day is, and well, for, even for myself to see that with working with a person that all of a sudden, it's just astounding. Mm-hmm. Louise, did you want to say something?
No, I'm still back in that complex of this.
Never conscious before.
Yeah, and your association of that with the belonging, and I was thinking, are those kinds of complexes so far from the personal experience? Mm-hmm. They carry that own personal flavor.
Very different, I think. Very numinous. Numinous is a word that you often run into in Jungian work, which is a word that means holding a kind of undescribable quality. I can think of I can think of a dream that the person only saw a mass of stars in the sky. I mean, this just an image, but an image so far removed from their personal life or anyone's personal life. And it arrived in the dream with such a powerful and intense emotion that it's something you know that it holds a quality that you can't quite describe. It's not quite magical. It's kind of magical. That's a kind of numinous is a word that Jung used for these kinds of occurrences. And those are deep appearances. Yeah, exactly. If it's demonic in that sense, or it could be numinous in a non-toxic, in a blissful sense. And oftentimes those little experiences, which are really big experiences, change someone's life. I don't know if anyone actually ever had that experience. Probably, you probably have at some point. And I think visions that people used to have, those are the similar kinds of things. So anyway, dreams bring up this information that we look for around these complexes that are unconscious. Active imagination is another way. Painting is a way that I find most useful. Painting or sculpting, it's just amazing what will appear if one forgets to plan a painting and forgets to paint good. It just paints. Well, I think that's a definite error, and something that I've been trying to stress tonight is that we're not talking about a pathology. I mean, this is where Jung and Freud split ways forevermore, and that, well, as we talked about last week, that as Jung said, the dream is a symptom of a neurotic symptom, and certainly he would say, Freud. I don't want to get them mixed up. Freud would say the dream is a neurotic symptom, and Freud would say the complex is also a neurotic symptom, and if we can bring it up and make it conscious, it'll dissolve and the repression will be gone and then you'll be healthy. And it's not stupid what he's saying. I don't want to leave that impression, because there certainly is a lot of truth to that and a lot more than that, I think. And that's where... Well, I think that we would have to describe the archetype of the father as holding all of the possible qualities a father could hold, both negative and positive. What constellated for this person in his young life was very negative, and that had an effect upon him that was very painful. Well, because his father beat him up and was drunk. So those aspects of the father that he experienced were only part of the innate archetypal qualities of the father that he holds within him, which are that and much more. The archetype holds within it also the qualities of the positive father, so that in a long and deep inner work, the idea would be to re-establish or connect that psyche to the qualities of the positive father that he never experienced in his life. And that's possible because they exist within his psyche already as innate or primordial images, and those are what we call archetypes. Possibly not. We have many archetypal components within our psyche, and only some of them become issues positively or negatively. Some of them never become constellated at all. It's because he suffered very much at the hands of his father, and that created a conflict within the psyche. He probably would have not... Had he had an ordinary father situation, then that conflict wouldn't have existed. I think what you're saying is that if a person had a negative personal experience with father, beating drunk father.
Being assertive negative is different.
Okay, but I got to draw some difference. So let's say the person had a drunken father, and the person as an adult wants to have a nurturing father. Let's say there was an absent father and he wanted to have a nurturing father. Would that work? Those are different. Is that what you mean? That he had both?
He had a father that wanted to beat him up, but he wanted to nurture him probably the same.
Exactly. Well, he probably still wants that today.
Yeah.
So,
but he's saying that's how the conflict was created.
Well, I think so. I think that's the same thing that I'm saying. I mean, most of us don't want to be beaten up. I mean, that's not our choice.
Sounds a lot like in the conscious world, where it's a malfunction, so it's two opposites.
It's transcendent function.
Transcendent.
It's all right. Yeah, it is. Yeah, well, that's the idea. If you can hold in consciousness both sides of the opposites, then eventually that changes. So if you can, like this guy with this negative father, if he can bring into consciousness that yes, he had this negative experience, and yes, he would want to have this positive experience, it will constellate, and they will come together, and that conflict will then drop away to a certain degree. I think to a great degree, as they integrate together. I know that happens. I don't want to get into a long discussion of the transcendent function, which I think is a little bit different from that. But so thank you very much for coming again. And,
and that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.